How disappointed were you guys that they didn't have any of the nipple plugs that you'd pull out and then watch the guy bleed to death? Like
the heart plug,
The heart plug,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, all those sort of like nits I had to pick. You know, I miss those things.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 2021. The universe is now ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV. And oh yes, I forgot to tell you, we finally got to see Dune! Finally! The Denis Villeneuve adaptation that was delayed until 2021 has been released. We originally talked about all the Dune adaptations back in episode 25, so we needed to do our Dune diligence and bring back our friend Daniel Ross to discuss the latest version of this unfilmable novel. Thank you for listening to the Grindhouse Institute. Please enjoy.
I've been having dreams about a girl on Arrakis. I don't know what it means.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray. The Emperor asks us to bring peace to Arrakis. House Atreides accepts!
The Duke's son sees too much.
This is my Dune. Kill them all. God in heaven.
All right, welcome back to the Grindhouse Institute. I'm Brian Foster, and with me, as always, is Jeremy Floyd. Hello, and how are you?
Yeah, doing okay. I think this desert has trained another faithful. We've got quite a bit of Dune here, and we can't get enough of it on this show, apparently.
No, we need two shows for it.
Because we're back. Back for an adundum. Dune 2021.
Just like Denis Villeneuve needs two movies to tell this story, we need three podcasts to also talk about it.
Exactly.
We have a very special guest with us returning to discuss more Dune. Jeremy, would you mind doing the intro?
Yeah. Well, we had this guest on to do Dune previously, so we needed to bring him back so we could do our adundum properly. Everybody, welcome back. Daniel Ross.
Thank you. Good to be here. We get to do this podcast as many times as they get to try to make this movie.
So. The unfilmable movie, yet they've filmed it three times already.
Yeah, we're in good shape.
Yeah, yes, they're going to keep trying.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the brand new Denis Villeneuve 2021 Dune. Just our thoughts and everything, because that was going to be part of our triple feature discussing Lynch's 84 version. John Harrison's miniseries that came out in 2000, and then now obviously the 2021 version, that, which is only half the book, or just about right. Half the book for this film. But I definitely am interested to hear your guys' thoughts on it, because I have my own, of course.
Well, so we had, I think, just to get the ball rolling, we had the focus of our conversation, I think, last time was ended up being kind of about the adaptation of this unadaptable book, mm-hmm. and you know, the different ways in which that happened or didn't happen with Jodorowsky's Dune, David Lynch's Dune, and John Harrison's Dune series. So I guess maybe it'd be interesting to hear you guys' thoughts about how you felt that this one was successful or not successful in that respect.
Dan?
Sure. It's interesting because I think Denis Villeneuve, it seemed like his principal goal in with this film was to kind of prove that cliche wrong. I don't know if that, you know, can you prove a cliche wrong? Yeah. But like
the unfilmable film?
Yeah. To sort of say like, no, I can do it, you know, and, mm-hmm. and I'm going to prove it to you that this can be done. And I think the film, like, he certainly succeeds where others have failed in putting together something that, you know, sustained a certain, like consistency of vision and production value that one would kind of, like, hope to see out of a major motion picture adaptation of this IP. But I have some thoughts on the sort of the success of mm-hmm. it, you know, as a work. But I think, you know, like you can say, like, you can give him in a pass fail grade, like pass marks on something that fulfills the like ambition to, you know, create a story that doesn't get derailed and kind of fizzle out into goofiness the way that the Lynch version ended up doing in mm-hmm. in the second half when it got taken away from him. And then, of course, like avoiding the pitfalls of the made-for-TV miniseries, although big asterisk there because I have thoughts on that.
Okay.
Piece of it too. And then, you know, it didn't bite off anywhere near what Jodorowsky intended.
Right.
No, bite off not even
his adaptation. But I think, yeah, like the sort of like sum of that is like, all right, yeah, like, yes, Denny, you can make an adaptation of Dune, you know, like mm-hmm. good for you. You hit most of the marks and
yeah.
it didn't like, you know, get all janky.
Because they say the story or the novel's unfilmable because it's so complicated, but really the main plot points of the story are not that complicated when you think about it.
Yeah.
And I think even right. Lynch hit those points in the 1984 film. And I thought that I was watching a remake of that film at the beginning of this film in many uh-huh. ways, you know, just a modern take on it with new visuals and new sound, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, I thought he did do a good job. I think there are some things that were omitted that I don't understand why for a 2.5 hour, half of a book, I think that they or half of a movie of supposedly, I think, two more or maybe just one more.
Mm-hmm.
But with the time that they had in this movie to spend on big sweeping shots of watching, you know, ornithopters fly over the sand, et cetera, you know, like maybe we could have got to that banquet, that big dinner scene. That's like a very important character development scene mm-hmm. that has been taken out of every one of these. Well, I think it was in the miniseries, mm-hmm. but that wasn't that well achieved.
Oh,
yeah.
You're talking about where they like just spill water on the ground and stuff like that. And
which
kind
they
of
just
learn.
Kind of, mm-hmm. they breezed past that, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Giving up the water of the body. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they did touch on that in the scene where Javier Bardem was spitting on the ground and, you know, I think it was played well for people who haven't read the book and aren't familiar with how the rules work, because you get to experience the culture shock of like, whoa, that's insulting to have somebody spit on your feet. But actually, in their culture, it's just the opposite. That's right. The sign of the greatest respect, right?
Yeah.
And I think that was a very efficient way to approach that. I mean, yeah, perhaps that banquet scene there could have been something that they enhanced out of that. I'm you know, it's
it was
possible.
Shot it was shot like there's
oh, really?
a lot of stuff I've read that was shot. There are pictures of Lady Jessica in her formal attire for that event.
Okay.
So it just didn't make this cut. I'm sure it'll make the next cut, or I don't know how they can retroactively fit that in. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think that for as long as this movie was, we could have had some more of those scenes in there.
I have to say, like, I mean, so I wonder if, okay, so Dune 2021 is part one.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dune 2024 or whatever is going to be part two.
Part Dune.
Yeah, part Dune. And combined, those will probably be about the same minute count as John Harrison's Sci-Fi Channel version, right?
So 5 hours.
Yeah, it'll probably be in that neighborhood because this one was, what, 2.5?
Mm-hmm.
And you just see, I mean, and obviously I think what we talked about a lot with the John Harrison thing is that there were all these budget limitations and it's hard, you know, not to talk about those things. But even so, you could see how well in this one they were able to at least orient the audience as to what the hell's happening. There is a lot of world building. There is a lot of things that are important and not important, you know, that you need to kind of push and pull your way into the story and like kind of pick and choose your moments. And I, you know, in that sense, I feel like they did a really good job of building a lot of that stuff and condensing things. Like, for instance, I think the biggest one for me Because I felt like the half of the story or whatever of the first book was pretty faithful in this as far as adaptations go. But one thing that kind of stood out that I thought was a great way to adapt it that they did in this one that they haven't done in the previous two was to sort of either just get rid of altogether or combine the Fade and Raban characters, the Fade Rautha and Beast Raban, mm-hmm. both sort of, I don't know, nephews of the Baron Harkonnen. It's like they play a very similar role. We'll just combine it. And, you know, you can have whatever villainy that the Beast gets up to. You can just have everything that Fade was going to do, have the Beast do it, potentially. You know, I don't know. Maybe in the next one they are going to have both characters. But in this one, it seems like they're going to just have that character be combined. And, Daniel, when we were talking about it last year, when you were talking about all the previous adaptations, I think you brought that up about how on sort of the other side of things, they had a similar, they had two characters when they could have used one with the sort of man of action, the Duncan Idaho and Gurney Halleck characters being split apart. And this is in the book and this is in all the movies and even in this movie. But it just seems, you know, when you're making that sort of adaptation from something super dense and complicated like a book into something, you know, a little more quickly digestible like a movie, that sort of character combination thing, you know, would be a benefit. And I think in this one they did it well.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the reasoning there, but I think you lose something, especially with Beast Raban and Fade, because I would say what this movie didn't do well, I didn't like their portrayal of the Harkonnen because it lost the like decadent, like ephebophilic or even pedophilic, mm-hmm. like sclerosity that the book and even the Lynch adaptation captures so well. And I mm-hmm. think
this was gone completely in this
totally
one.
Gone. Yeah. And I think the like beautiful boy Fade Rautha character that Sting played so memorably, like
uh-huh.
it does.
He was made to play Fade. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's like an interesting foil there also for Paul. And right. I think it creates like a richer sense of like aristocratic decrepitude and villainy and decadence to have that element. And he represented that, I think, a lot, in addition to the Baron, who also like lost mm-hmm. his sort of vices beyond gluttony. You know, there wasn't any of those scenes where it was like, bring me a boy, you know? And
right. No, it was just him floating around in oil and balsamic vinegar for most of the time.
Yeah. I wanted to dip my baguette in it.
I got a lot of Brando Apocalypse Now out of this Baron.
Oh, you caught that? Yeah.
When he came out exactly. of that black pool, when he was healing from the or, poison or whatever, I was like, okay, there it is.
Or the very first time you saw him, like you were just miming there, Daniel, with the you know wiping the sweaty head like Apocalypse Now.
It was a very one perfect shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right there.
It's
yeah.
like, yep, I've seen this movie. Here we go. That's an interesting point. I guess I hadn't really thought about that in a certain sense because, like, they spent a lot of time developing the Atreides world and sort of none at all with the Harkonnen. And I think if you had to choose between the two, I think that's the way to go. I mean, essentially, there is, in the book and in the previous adaptations, there's a lot of emphasis on the Harkonnen and their decadence and their greed and all these other things. However, in the book and the previous adaptations, like the Harkonnen are also pretty one note in the sense that, well, they're just, you know, pure evil and there's nothing redeeming about them. And okay, so pure evil, what do you need? Just a dark castle and, you know, a gluttonous fat guy who, you know, sane and doing evil things. Got it. It's not as if we're trying to, you know, peel back the onion on the Harkonnen. You know what I mean? It's there's not much there.
Sure, yeah. I think it's what flavor evil
yeah.
do you prefer? And I guess the more disgusting, the better for
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Black licorice.
Yeah. Liquid black licorice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. for me, the most difficult part was the ending, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, like, that is basically where I thought it was going to end, which is Paul getting,
right,
you know,
accepted and,
you know, started on his journey through the sort of desert and, you know, learning to be a Fremen or whatever.
Into the siege. Yeah.
Into the siege. But I was really hoping they would find a way to make it feel like an ending versus this where it's like,
to be continued.
Yeah. Let me get to this commercial break and we'll be back in right. 2 years, you know?
Yeah. You weren't satisfied with one line from Zendaya. Like, yeah. This is just the beginning. Shit, I was here for 2.5 hours.
That is on par with the narration from the Lynch version. That's like, oh, I forgot to tell you.
Exactly. It's such a clunky intro.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, stand in front of this blue screen. We're going to put stars behind you and talk.
Yeah. Well, that I mean, to me, like, not to, like, blow the, we can finish the episode now because I'll give my verdict on the entire thing. But I think we've kind of mentioned this a couple of times, which to me, the first time I saw it was in Dolby Cinema, and my chair was like literally rattling, yeah, with the sound, and I was overpowered by, really the sound design.
Yes.
And the score.
Are you talking about the voice?
Yeah. the right frequency, yeah, on me. But I had this like sneaking or this gnawing sense in my head, and I had some questions. So then I watched it again on HBO Max, and it kind of confirmed it. And I was like, yep, this feels like a prestige TV pilot. That's what this is. It's not a movie. It's the first episode of a high production value HBO Max series.
Which would totally get picked up, you know, production wise alone. They'd be like, sure, this looks great. You know, show it, but show us 10 more episodes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that the way that it ends like a pilot that wants to hook you and get you binging the next, you know, several episodes. Because it does have that effect where you're like, ugh, like, give me more. It doesn't feel like a resolution note. It's a cliffhanger.
Perhaps a cliffhanger would have worked, though, with the battle, the holy battle there to allow Paul to enter, you know, the fight to the death. Maybe end before that or right before that or something to kind of leave that on that cliffhanger. Or is Paul mortally wounded during that, and then that we kind of end there, something like that. But the way that it ended is kind of
like have the next scene, where it's like, okay, so in the next scene in the book is he gets in and they have a little funeral for Janus or whatever his name is, the guy that he kills reluctantly in that battle to the death at the end there.
Not so reluctantly in this one.
It was still, he was like, do you yield. He tried to
pulled a really badass move, though, on him in the end to take him out, though.
It's a spin move.
Yeah. With a flourish, you just killed that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, after three do you yields, he had to take him out with some style. You know, he had, yeah.
I asked you nicely three times, guy.
Yeah.
No.
I'm tired of asking. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's more than you get from, you know, certain other figures of authority in this world.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I think the thing is that if they had taken it to that next scene, perhaps that would have felt more like an ending where it's like, you know, you have the funeral for Janus or whatever, and then, you know, you have his reaction to it and everyone getting, you know, being in awe of his display of tears or whatever, and then maybe it's something about, you know, his mother tries to implore him again to try and leave and get off planet or whatever. And like, we need to go back home. And he's like, no, I am home or something like that. Right. It's like,
there you go.
You'd have a way to feel like, okay, this piece of the story is over.
Now it's the desert, Paul. Now it's.
And then, you know, right where we pick up, it's whatever, 3 or 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we see a changed Paul, or, you know, a new name for Paul at that point.
Oh, yeah. Spoilers. Yeah. No one knows what
that is. Yeah. I think also just in terms of focus, this one had a little more focus, again, by not, you know, doing much with the Emperor and, you know,
not even
having
in it.
Yeah, exactly. Like
no space guild, really. Well, the guild showed up, but not the, the fish people or the.
Well, they were. I think they were there in the scene where the emissary from the Emperor comes with his scroll. You know, we see them with their like gold gas suits.
Yeah, full of spice gas, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, full of spice gas. Yeah. But I think, I mean, this is sort of like going back to the earlier point about like Villeneuve's goal of sort of making like the competent adaptation of like somebody's finally going to do a competent version of this. Like, I think it's at the expense of atmosphere and I don't know, vibes. Like for me, like the most indelible scene in the Lynch version is the Emperor Spacing Guild scene. Like Lynch's vision of what a spacing guild navigator looks like, and having the translator the with the like, scrambled speech, which
and it turns into English. Yeah,
that they like they copied in this on the Seleucus Secundus planet.
Yeah, exactly.
That stuff was so much more just you know rich and interesting than this version, which just again felt like very like hitting the marks, you know,
right,
like, okay,
right.
like it's, it's a competent thing. Like we don't have to worry about it, but it doesn't have that, imagination to it that Lynch brought. And it's certainly not going to stick with me that scene, but the scrotum guy coming out in that weird sort of steampunk tank, you know, like that
giant
is
giant fish tank. Yeah.
So yeah. I love it.
But you know, and also I think the Lynch aesthetic nailed the Bene Gesserit look a lot better too, where it felt very otherworldly. It you know, when you're describing them as witches, it's not just someone in mourning, which is what kind of what we saw in Villeneuve.
Right.
But they're just these other people, and like, you know, they do the monk thing where they shave their heads, and you know, it's like they have the long flowing black and gold, whatever, and it's like they're very distinct looking.
That headpiece that they would wear that just kind of covered the bottom. Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed even the Gom Jabbar more scene and more in Lynch's. It had more of a grittiness to it or a grounded feel to it. Denny left this all to your imagination. And while I'm fine with that, I like that Lynch just poured on the burning hand and every pain well, that Paul felt.
Yeah, he did the Superman vision through the box or whatever.
Body horror.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
well, you did get the body horror in the sense that, you know, we're kind of seeing his imagination now. I feel like it gets a little lost because we're seeing so much of Dune in the desert and whatever. But that charred hand is supposed to be what he's dealing with. Mm-hmm. It would have been, it seems like if they had focused the amount of mind's eye flash cuts we saw to be more about the pain in his hand, we would have gotten that effect without having the like, ooh, is it too cringy to have the Superman vision on the box?
Yeah.
But other than that, I feel like that scene in particular, you know, it wasn't overplayed, and you know, you do get the point of what was going on. He's disoriented. You know, the audience in theory is going to be disoriented a little bit, but by the end of it, you know that. Where everything stands, and you know that like the Lady Jessica, like how she was feeling, because we got to see her outside, and you know how we had a scene I think before this where she was upset about something, was like kind of crying in the hallway, and then had to like gather herself real quick and then go inside and present herself. And you know, we got to see that sort of in reverse, where she was gathered delivering Paul to this and then had to step outside to be able to express herself. And, you know, I feel like in that sense that they did a lot of those things really well, whereas, you know, with the John Harrison thing, I mean, the sci-fi thing, it was unintelligible for those first two episodes. In the David Lynch, you know, they solved that adaptation device by having voiceover from a hard to understand because they're whispering, but then also hard to pick out who is doing the whispering, you know, because it's like every whisper almost sounds the same, you know.
Yeah, and while that's happening, are they just sitting in the room just like waiting for the voiceover to end? How awkward is that for everyone count. Else?
Yeah.
You're thinking, and
it's the Italian, like spaghetti western style of directing where it's like start counting to six or whatever. Yeah. Uno, due.
I appreciate what you're saying. I do think though that they, in their quest to kind of be understated in a certain way, like I think they took it too far. So like Charlotte Rampling was underused, I thought, and the costume,
that's for sure,
like obscured her face and didn't let her really be the character. And the audience, you know, there was just this distance that, you know, you can understand, like, okay, well, we're kind of seeing it from Paul's perspective and he's sort of mystified by this stuff. But I think just as an aesthetic, it was limiting.
Well, she does have a very powerful voice, even when she's not using, quote, the voice.
It's true, yeah.
But I do agree, like, she also has extremely piercing eyes, which would have, I think, helped that moment.
Right. And I think, like, another thing this film kind of suffers from is the sort of, like, Dark Knight-ification of all movies. Like, after The Dark Knight, like, everything had to be so serious. Like, everything is so
actually, I trace that serious. Back to the Born Identity movies, but you're right. It's you know, The Dark Knight took it to the next level, and everything's copying The Dark Knight now.
Yeah, but at least The Dark Knight had like a really memorable performance, which I would say this.
And it wasn't of the title character.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think this movie doesn't have that. There's nobody that sort of like steals the show.
No.
At all.
I agree.
I was dying for somebody to like step forward and be the star, and nobody. Nobody took it on, and I think that's a lot of the fault is the script, really. Like, nobody had the platform to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the areas, I wouldn't have, like, necessarily, I didn't want this to be him, and I wouldn't have expected it, but, like, the writing for Gurney was just so earnest and straightforward.
Yeah. They're sort of brutal!
That line sucked. That line was so bad.
Yeah,
and he was kind of like a little bit of a silly goose in the book, and you know, and he had this lightness to him. He had his
come here, you young pup, my young pup.
We didn't get,
we didn't get that
Atomics. That's right.
I love that one. I didn't feel any of that from Brolin's version.
No, he just seemed like an MMA fighter or something, more so than. Jason Momoa, you know.
Although I did like Duncan much more in this version than I liked him in previous one. He didn't do anything in Lynch's version. I mean, there were a few, and in the miniseries, he went out in the worst way. It was just like missiles got shot into something, and he just like flew out of there. It was really shitty.
Yeah.
But at least this one, he got what he was supposed to do. You know, he's supposed to take out Sardaukar. He took out a whole, you know, group of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and they gave his death. You know, more meaning than you were saying in some of the other adaptations. And I think Gurney as a character becomes more of a character in sort of the second half of the first book. And so perhaps, you know, that's part of it. When you're trying to get the audience to care about somebody, well, you care about the one who's going to die in this one, right? And like, you know, we all know who Josh Brolin's character is in this one, so we'll get a little more meat on the bone next time, perhaps. The Oscar Isaac character, when he's out among the like sort of Stonehenge, you know, tombs out there in the field, at least we got a little scene there where they have some sort of relationship. I think in all the other versions, even the sci-fi version where, what's his name?
William Hurt?
William Hurt was playing the Duke. Like, we didn't really get, you know, much of an attachment, so that when the Duke dies, you know, you don't care, right? In this one, at least, you know, potentially you give a shit when he dies.
But on the other side of that, I don't think they gave enough weight to Piter, the Mentat, because the Mentat, he's like running the show, and, you know, he's a very much more influential character with the Baron. He's got the Baron's ear and all that.
Yeah.
And in this one, they didn't really give him much again. The look was awesome. Like, don't get me wrong. I really liked how David Dust Malkian, how he was put together and everything. And I like his performance. but he could have done so much more. And then when he did die with the tooth. When the tooth got him, like he just kind of faded out in the clouds of poison smoke, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was like I didn't really care that he died. Like that should have been a much more impactful kill, you know, for the good guys. You know, a good win for the good guys there, but it didn't really have that kind of weight.
Yeah, but the tragedy is all on the Duke Leto. I like this Duke.
Right.
That's the audience's internal narration.
Damn the spice!
They put a white hat on him in the thopter.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about the Mentats, because I think overall that was the weakest piece of this entire production. But
I thought it was going to be great. They set up Thufir so great in that first scene when you first get introduced to him, and as he's doing the calculations in his head, his eyes turn white, and he really nailed something, and I was like, is he going to be doing this? Like I could watch this for a whole movie, but it doesn't happen.
He just doesn't have much to do at all, and he just seems like an incompetent fool.
Yeah, which is totally not Thufir.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And then even worse, actually, sorry, not the Mentat wasn't the worst thing. The worst thing was Dr. Yue.
Yeah.
I think, like, for somebody who doesn't know the story, I honestly don't think, like, does it even register the sort of betrayal that is happening? I think like the story completely decides this is not important.
You didn't set him up enough as a good guy.
Yeah.
and he, you know, he's also got, he's very chummy with Paul. And I think they did that in the Lynch movie. I thought, was it Harry Dean? No.
Dean Stockwell.
From Quantum Leap?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he seemed a little bit more, you know, involved in Paul's life. You know, they would talk and he would teach him a little bit about Arrakis and the Harkonnen and all that. And then this one, Yue was kind of a side character that was just there to, like, help. Yeah. He was almost the help. Like,
and he had the conditioning, which imbues him with an inherent trust, which is something that the Atreides didn't even have to worry about him as... That was the most important thing about his character, is that he can't be the traitor because he has this sort of baked in programming that means he's not the traitor. And absent that fact in this story, it loses registers of narrative, resonance. That it's just like, oh, well, yeah, okay, I don't know.
Yeah,
I guess
and that could have been solved with a one line.
No, you're right. It could have been solved. You're right. And it could have been solved in that scene after the little needle thing comes into
his
room.
Yes, the hunter killer.
And it's like, you know, someone suspects UA or something, and they're like, no, can't be. I mean, I think that's even how they do it in the book.
Right.
But I think, again, a lot of that stuff is like stuff that you can do in the book that, you need to simplify a little bit. But, you know, I know what you're saying, like, maybe not that, I don't know what, he's programmed through MK Ultra to be loyal. Maybe we don't have to have those details, but like just, okay, he's just a loyal, he's always been a part of the family for generations or whatever. He helped my father or whatever. And, you know, you just kind of, you know, have that throwaway line to, you know, explain why everybody trusts him so thoroughly. And then, oh no, he... also has this this idiotic plan. In this one, his plan was idiotic because he thought he was going to get his wife back or something. Whereas in the book, he knew he was not going to get that, but he wanted to try and kill the Baron.
No, it was virtually the same idea. The problem was
maybe I missed that detail
in the book, and then in the Lynch version, like there's more. They establish the scheme in greater detail, so the conspiracy is like more fleshed out, and you understand Yue's motivations in real time. It isn't like backfilled as a sort of like, let me explain, Mr. Bond, how you're going to die sort of thing. You know, like, so you're sort of with it, and there's irony baked in, and there are scenes where he's interacting with the Baron, and the Baron has him strung along thinking that his wife is captive, and so the sort of like you know, wordplay that the Baron is doing is, you know, I told you I would return or
free her
or be with her and kill. Yeah. So you like, we, the audience can see that coming, but it needed more, time to interact between the characters.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like he knew that in the book, the UA character knew that his wife was dead, despite whatever the Baron was saying. And his whole plan was just to kill the Baron and
vengeance.
Like, sorry, Duke, I had to use you to get to him or something like that. But I mean, perhaps I'm forgetting that detail.
I might be too.
Yeah.
This is a rigorous podcast. Right?
Yeah. No, but I think regardless, I mean, like we got enough of that to understand what's going on, you know, where we don't need to go too much further for, you know, how brief this character's there. I know what you're saying, though. Like, you know, you do get a lot more out of it when you understand that, you know, I don't know, these advisors or whatever are there. And, you know, there's this almost genetic programming.
They can't be corrupted, or,
you know, doesn't allow them to lie and to the people they serve. You know, and you also then further get this idea of how, you know, rigid and, you know, how much of a caste system this world is in. But I don't know. I kept trying to think about it after the movie. I was like, I wonder how much of this, if you were just to watch it knowing nothing about the Duneverse, like, would you know this stuff and like and be able to, like, you know, get the world building? I feel like they got the crucial stuff. I wonder if some of the, you know, richer stuff was missing, and that's what kind of some of the stuff you're responding to.
Well, I think on that point, I would totally say that this version was missing the, like, pervasive aesthetic of Dune. Like, I did not feel watching this the way I felt reading the book or even watching the Lynch version. I don't think it captured the and I think this is what people mean by the unfilmable, is that it really didn't capture the sort of like uncanniness of the universe that Herbert created. And I think that was because it was so, like, focused on the mechanics of, like, the world building stuff and depicting it almost like in documentary detail. You know, it didn't have that mystery or mystique, I should say.
I wonder if part of what you're responding to there is the fact that we saw all of these extremely complicated mechanical devices that, you know, part of the whole thing is that the world is not supposed to have computers, and it was supposed to be something that disappeared eons ago.
But are still on X.
Many machines on X.
But instead they have this, like, you know, this form of magic which they've, you know, discovered you know, out in the desert, right? And you know, it's you know, kind of a metaphor for the combustion engine or whatever, right? And okay, but I think if they had somehow captured the magical aspects of the way that they do interstellar travel or whatever, and, you know, the way that they still rely on swords and stuff for a lot of their combat, right? It's like there'd be a lot of that uncanniness like you're talking about, and perhaps, you know, that's some of the stuff we were all responding to when looking into the mind's eye of Yodorowsky and seeing what he had planned for it, was some of the stuff where it's like, you know, you'd have an ornithopter, which, okay, maybe it's not as helicopter like as it is in this thing. I mean, I think they did a good job, like, realizing those wings and then creating, like, you know, sort of dangerous scene where, like, the you know, the one wing wasn't working and the other wing snapped off, and, you know, I think they did a good job with all that stuff. But it's like, you know, there was too much left to your imagination that, oh, this is just space travel, and the way that people get around in the space travel is through you know, computers and, you know, rockets and all this kind of stuff. Whereas in the world of Dune, that's supposed to be kind of in this realm of more like magic and stuff. Same with the Mentats and the, what are they called? The Bene Gesserit and all that kind of stuff, where it's like, and then so therefore everything else in the world feels just off kilter, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, maybe that's actually a really great way to distill it. I think, in reading the book, trying to envision an ornithopter was always a bit challenging for me, and it seemed like a goofy contraption.
Yeah.
Right. Operates then, like an animal or like a bug or
Yeah. And then, but I think that, in the Villeneuve version, they did do such a good job of making it seem like legit that it demystified it in a way that was, on the one hand, I was like, oh, like, I didn't expect them to make an ornithopter look like kind of cool and functional.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, they kind of stripped it of its magic for me. It's like almost too, like, it makes too much sense. It seems like too much of a real thing. Like, oh yeah, that does seem like something that the military would make.
I think the mystique really maintained though with the Harkonnen and how Baron Harkonnen would move himself around. He was such a fat rhinoceros that he couldn't get up off his ass and actually walk. So he'd be, I don't know, covered in that anti-grav or whatever that was on his back. It would just light up.
The suspensors. Yeah. I agree. That was good. And I think a little bit better than the Lynch version where he was kind of, you know, it was almost like he was flying around on a rope or a jetpack.
He'd like blow it up like it was helium or something, like it was a big balloon.
Exactly.
Like the blueberry in Willy Wonka.
The Duke will die before these eyes and he'll know that it is I, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, who encompasses his doom.
What'd you guys think of production quality, Denis Villeneuve's visual. I think he's a master of the visuals, to be honest, in my opinion. But what did you guys think of it overall? I mean, you said that some of the costuming you didn't agree with. But.
Well, I mostly just in sort of contrast to the Lynch stuff. I mean, I think that's where a lot of that was coming from. I mean, especially since, okay, well, you have the template to work off of, and you know what I mean, you can kind of. But I think a lot of that is sort of to your complaint, Daniel, about like, you know, the way things look are too recognizable. You know, we all know what space suits and, you know, future fantasy costumes look like. And this looked like a lot of that stuff. You know, okay, so he nailed the still suits and it wasn't just you know, the Ghostbusters, you know, zip up thing that was in the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, it was closer to what you imagine these things to be, with the nose thing and the mask and the like little tubes and pockets, and it looks complicated as hell, and so obviously it makes sense when they are surprised that he knows how to put it on, right?
Desert fashion.
Yeah, right. With the way he crosses his boots or whatever.
Yeah.
What
is that? Does he just French cuff him at the bottom? Is that like a cool thing that they used to do in the 80s?
And... Yeah, he's pegged his pants.
You know how to roll your desert smokes up in your sleeve.
I've seen MTV a few times.
Yeah.
You want to still suit the form.
I think the other thing was, and I think this is in the book, they talk about the vid books or something like that, and they do some of that in this, and it's like, you know, if you'd removed that that detail, or like, you know, changed some of the costuming what's their planet, what's the ocean planet, Caladan, you would maybe start to get some of that off-kilter feel, and you know, this is something we haven't experienced before, and it's not quite as safe. And I think that a lot of those things are the things you guys are responding to a little bit, which is like, you know, even though it's all very competent here, it's also all very safe, you know? And, you know, okay, so it's a $400 million movie or whatever it costs, and you know the safety button is secured and fastened and double triple locked, and you know we're not going to be able to move too far out of that. But it's interesting, like his just in terms of your question about you know the Villeneuve aesthetic, right? It's like that's part of the thing that like I was kind of thinking about the other day after watching it, and it's like even you know through whether it's Prisoners or Enemy or you know Arrival or Sicario or one of these things, it's like you know in all those movies, okay, there's something grounded there, so you're kind of the way you're seeing it is sort of supposed to relate to the way the world looks, but then you know he often does these things where it's otherworldly, and I think Enemy is a perfect example of that, with you know the sort of wide shots of the city and there's this you know lingering smog over everything, and then you know the quality of light and everything like that. And in that movie he's able to make Toronto or wherever it was taking place look like a different world, and in this one, you know, okay, the architecture and the sort of medieval power structures or whatever are otherworldly. And it's all very sort of, you know, beautiful and competent and everything else. But it didn't have that, again, that off-kilter thing that we've been talking about where it's like, and that's something he's totally capable of doing, you know, again, cite Enemy as an example, right?
I'll give him credit. Like some of the aesthetics that I did like, he got the most important thing right, in my opinion, about sci-fi that's set in space, which is slow ships. They have to be slow,
yeah,
and massive and sublime. That's so important to just like linger on those shots where you see this, you know, behemoth,
yeah,
entering the frame, and you can't really. Suss out its propulsion source, you know,
right?
That I think he did really well.
Or it's like hard to compare its scale, and then all of a sudden you see the planet, you're like, oh my god. Yeah
So those things were good. And you know, I think some of the production design was like some of the interior stuff was good. I like the little details like the suspensor lamps. I thought that stuff was nice. I thought for as long as this movie was, and I know I appreciate the sort of desire to tighten it up, but I thought the movie was like at its best when it had these kind of like lyrical moments. The two that come to mind for me was when Paul is going in to do the Gom-Jabbar test. They're kind of about to go in, and there's a cutaway to a bunch of the Bene Gesserit sisters kind of like conferring in the shadows, and they sort of like slip away into a dark sort of stage right or whatever, stage left. And those touches, like I feel like there could have been more of those kinds of touches that inject more of that mystery into the world and the sort of unknown, like you can't quite perceive all of the machinations going on.
Well, actually two things like that. One was in the scene with the hunter gatherer, what was that thing called?
Hunter seeker.
Right before it gets to him, he's walking through some sort of, you know, projected image, and the look on his face, and you know, all the little you know, sources of light, you know, running down all over. I think, you know, that was great, aesthetically speaking. And, you know, it felt strange and a little uncanny. And I feel like, you know, it would have been nice to have a little more of that. And the other one was, you know, you were talking about some of these nice moments with, you know, where we're taking our time. And I felt like, you know, there were little spots, you know, sort of throughout the movie where they made sure to take a second to, you know, focus on that, you know, 3D Picasso you know, sculpture of the bullfighting, you know, the mounted head of the bull with the very strange horns, and, you know, kind of having that be part of this running theme throughout it. And I feel like they did a really good job, you know, both sort of aesthetically and thematically, weaving that into the, you know, such an epic and long and complicated story.
My favorite moment like that, it was kind of I'm ambivalent about it because I think narratively it was really good, and almost it kind of reminded me of something Spielberg might do, which was the Muad'Dib moments, the little mouse.
Yeah, the close-ups of the mouse.
I thought that was a really great touch. Now, I hated the mouse, this like CGI. It was like so just like, it just screamed like CGI. I wish it was just like a real animal or something.
Yeah. The close-up of the ear got to me.
Yeah, but I thought the like moment, letting it breathe, wondering like, what is this mouse doing on these dunes surviving out here in the desert?
Right.
Now, of course, we know, being familiar with the story, sort of what that's foreshadowing. But I thought that was like a really good touch that will pay off later for everybody, whether you know the story or not. You know, it has that nice.
No, you're right. That was something, and perhaps technologically, you know, it was out of the reach in 1984. But they, you know, I feel like they didn't even have that show up at all in the Lynch Dune.
They just talked about the spot on the moon. In the shape of the desert mouse. Yeah.
And so it was nice to, you know, have them actually take the time to do that. Yeah.
They took a little too much time in the miniseries with the horrible effects they had there.
Yeah. Sock puppet.
Yeah, exactly. You wanted a cutaway to a screen that says, you know, mouse here or whatever instead. but that reminds me. So that scene right before we get some of the moments with the desert mouse, you know, the ornithopter just crashed, and you know they were hiding out or whatever, and they're in that little tent, and they did something that I think perhaps feels more obvious and oh no, this is a little too movie of them to do, but I felt was effective, which was to have, you know, Paul not be the, you know, totally closed off, emotionless, and stoic Jedi master, which, you know, in the book, you know, the moment all the betrayals start happening, he just like, you know, boom, light switch turns off, and he's now this totally internal being and exterior. He doesn't cry. He doesn't express himself. He doesn't talk about things other than, you know, sort of these, you know, sage ways of talking. And what was interesting and what I felt they did a good job of in this one was to have him, you know, have an emotional reaction to his dad dying and all these things. You know, and again, like the other two adaptations that were realized went closer to what the book portrays. But the problem is that, you know, we don't get the contradictory internal monologue, which the book also portrays. So, you know, the external facade is, you know, this, you know, very stony faced, you know, nothing can touch me. And then on the inside, you know, he's in turmoil. And okay, so the way that we experience movies, it's through, you know, the actor and, you know, and being able to like understand what's going on internally, being expressed like a human. And he does that. And, you know, we just, you know, got rid of that piece of the book, which, again, I think just in terms of adapting it to screen is something you needed to do, and you needed to find another way to make the Lady Jessica, you know, worry about Paul because he's so strange or whatever. Now,
I thought they could have done it in subtitles. They used a lot of subtitles in the movie. You know, that opening, I think it's one of either the Sardaukar or the Navigators. It's one of the languages that's in the movie. And there's a subtitle on there that kind of gives the opening of the film.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's almost as if you, like, in the middle of conversations, it might have been a really interesting move to just put up what the person was thinking underneath, like, in a subtitle. Or, you know, text on screen. It might have been an interesting way to portray that.
Now you're thinking like somebody who can take on an adaptation of Dune.
Yeah.
You can't adapt that. It's unfilmable, Dan. Let's be honest here.
No, but I mean, they did do a really good job. This is another thing real quick. They did do a really good job of, like, you know, the little hand symbols and stuff that they were doing, that little sign language and
some
of the
other
languages and things they were doing. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. And, like, you know, how were they able to outsmart these guys on the Ornithopter? Well, you know, we understood what was going on exactly, and you know that they had this sort of secret way of communicating with one another. You know, the audience was clued into all that, even if perhaps they didn't know all the sort of details that the book gets into. They gave you enough of it to, you know, be able to experience the story.
On to your point, Jeremy, I think one thing that will be interesting to see play out in part two is the themes that come through so clearly in the book, because the book almost literally just tells you that, like, beware of messiahs, messiah bad, everybody.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, it's a more naturalistic, you know, he does have these visions and he does kind of like babble a little bit about what he's worried about, but the volume on the idea of, like, yes, you live in a, you know, fascistic, aristocratic hell world, and also maybe a messiah that isn't the answer either, you know, like that. The book does a great job of that tension.
Of pushing both those things, yeah.
Yeah, and so, like, what will be really boring will be if, like, in part two, it's the sort of, like, Anakin Skywalker story of, like, oh no, you used to be so noble and pure of heart and well-intentioned, and now you're villainous and corrupted. Like, it's going to have to hinge on the Fremen more and sort of how they respond to it. Because I don't, you know, I do think Timothy Chalamet is the best Paul, you know.
I agree.
Hats off to him. I was a little bit, you know, skeptical, but he did a good job, I thought.
Yeah.
And, but I don't think, like, I'm still not super interested in his arc in that sense of it. Like, I don't know. I think they need to play with the, like, contradictions of, like, what he is. He's a colonizer. He's a part of a fascist, like, state. He is a satanic kind of messiah that is going to, like, burn the universe. You know, like, if it sort of stays close to Paul the individual and his personal arc, and do we care about him as a human being? Like, I think that's where the unfilmable stuff comes in, because it really does, like, move away from the sort of, like, character-driven concerns of, like, what we're accustomed to with this kind of story, and it becomes more sort of thematically, yeah, almost like essayistic.
Yeah.
Whatever. What if the rug means is completely pulled out under all of us on part two, and they film the end of Jodorowsky's Dune and have Dune fly off into the universe somewhere?
Oh yeah,
the Dune spore. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When the Harkonnen had Dr. Yue's wife, they said that they were picking her apart, like pulling up, or they said that they would pull her apart, like pull her appendages apart. Like that was a line that they used. I wonder, was that in the book? Or was that an ode to Duke Leto's death of Jodorowsky's Dune?
Maybe. I don't remember how she was supposed to have died in the book. That's a good question. But yeah, I was definitely thinking of that too. I was like, oh, that seems like the death of Duke Leto in the Jodorowsky version. Mm-hmm. To this question of, you know, where's the Paul story going? It's going to be an interesting one. You know, unfortunately, start to have worries of, like, oh, is this going to go in a Game of Thrones direction with this whole thing? And, like, you know, in the first book, which is the only one I've read, it's like, you know, he keeps seeing these visions of the sort of jihad or crusade, as they say in this one, that he will inspire. And, you know, that, you know, he's trying to fight against a future that he keeps seeing in these visions and you know, trying to push on these things and all these things. In the book, anyway, that seems to be where that struggle is. Like, there's sort of the real world, you know, Game of Thrones power struggle of, you know, Harkonnen and the Emperor and all this other, you know, the Fremen and the Dune or Arrakis or whatever, and all of that. And then there's also the sort of internal, you know, spiritual, should I even try to do this thing? You know, what if by doing this, I unleash something even worse? You know, and I think to the Fremen, they probably can't imagine anything worse, but, you know, they, and this seems like the way to go, but, you know, that is an interesting aspect of the book. And I think, again, when we're talking about the way that Jodorowsky's script was to end, was different than the book, but captures that spirit of, like, you know, that Paul was going to be this catalyst and this agent of change for this world or universe or, you know, whatever they're in at the moment. Like, we'll change everything, essentially. And the question is, I guess, you know, it's like, will that struggle of should he do it, should he not do it, is this going to create more harm than good, like that kind of thing. You know, all that's very interesting. It seems like they're hinting at that's it's going to be a part of it, and I really hope so. But yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. What did you guys think of the Fremen?
Yeah, I mean,
didn't get a lot of them, right?
I was just about to, yeah, exactly. I was about to say, like, we didn't get a whole lot, and I'm wondering if you're unfamiliar with the text.
Right.
Would you be able to get much out of the Fremen and the way that it was portrayed? Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that one. I the way I felt about it was like, okay, well, it's you know, pretty faithfully portrayed in certain ways, and, you know, we're still on the outside.
Right, that's what in. I was gonna say. Yeah, we're not in that in the siege yet as yeah. As the audience. Yeah, because the only thing that we get out of them is we meet Stilgar, and a handful of them, and also Dr. Kynes. It's not Dr. Kynes, I think. Right? Is it Dr. Kynes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then we also see one of the, you were talking about the vid books, but I think in this one it's more like a projector, right? That he's got sitting on the ground, yeah. Of the. The movement through the desert, so they don't get tracked by sandworms or Shai Halud. We got a little bit of that stuff, but I think that if there's more than one extra part coming, if it's two and three, or if it's two, I think that should be very Fremen focused, because it should be all about the desert and the desert power at this point, right? I mean, that's where at least they were leading to.
Yeah, that's true. I think it was a sort of faithful. Like, of all of the things, it was sort of the most faithfully done, I thought. And now that I think about it, I might revise what I said earlier about wanting somebody to step forward and steal the show. I won't say he steals the show, but Javier Bardem was probably my favorite actor.
But I didn't feel like we got enough of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I loved, like, every scene he was in. Like, it's always a joy to watch him, and
agreed. Yeah.
He does a really good job, and like Timothy Chalamet, best Paul, he's definitely the best Stilgar.
I just love that he comes in not going to take any shit from the new rulers of his planet. You know, the new folks that are now going to run the show. He's like, whatever, you're not going to be the first, or you're not the first. You're not going to be the last, right? There's going to be more of you after this. So
you're the new babysitter. Don't care. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and I think what I like about his performance, he's such a good actor, and what he does so well is that, like, despite the Dark Knight or Bornification of this film, he has this, like, dead seriousness, but underneath it, a little bit of, like, comic relief in the contrast.
You got that toward the end in some of that, the tension-breaking moments there when... You know, Paul and Jessica, you know, meet up with Stilgar and crew, and it's like, you know, he showed a little bit of that in the scene you're talking about, Brian, but like also, I think, and more of it anyway, in you know, in the sort of later scenes that we saw him in. The
desert was ours long before you came.
It feels like, you know, we've got a lot to expect from the next one, which will be part two of book one. But kind of like what we keep hinting at here, it feels like, you know, perhaps like the, you know, some other superhero, you know, cinematic universes and whatever else. And like you were talking about earlier, Daniel, like that this is, you know, the first step onto doing the entire Dune series. And I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what, I haven't read anything about it or whatever, but it has that feeling where, you know, the end of part two will only be the end of book one. And that while it feels like when you get to the end of book one, a piece of the story's done, there's a lot more to go. And it feels like they're going to probably want to push that, especially since it seems like this movie's received well and successful and all that.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly have their work cut out for them, and we have some weird movies in store if they decide, if their path truly does lie in the desert.
Maybe in 5 years when this next movie is completed and fully produced, then we'll have to meet up again for another podcast to talk about that one.
Totally, yeah. 4 years from now, or whatever.
Well, maybe by then all computers will be banished, and you know, it'll be a different setup.
We won't be able to stream it. We will have to go to the theater.
Yeah, to podcast live. Yeah, exactly.
I've never met Harkonnens before. They're not human. They're brutal.
Well, I'm excited to hear that you saw it in the theater. At least I went and watched it at the IMAX over here. Mm-hmm. It was pretty insane.
Yeah.
You know, they did shoot whatever it was, you know, 60% of it, or all the set pieces anyway, in the Alexa digital version of the IMAX. It was, you know, a large format digital thing. It was pretty insane seeing it blown up like that. But
yeah,
I imagine most people who have seen it have probably just saw it at home, right? I don't know. The theater was packed when I was there, but which was weird because it was a noon screening on a Saturday or something.
I did an 11:30 a.m. on a Sunday.
That's the time to go.
This is real adult hours here. Yeah.
That's the time to go. I love that time.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's true. The sound was crazy. It was just like, I was the Maxell guy. Like,
yeah.
Holy shit.
Well, what was great was like feeling that the audience was getting either scared by or you know, into, you know, seeing the danger of the sandworm or whatever, especially during the like scene where the harvester or whatever was getting sucked in, you know, seeing the like ripples of sand coming, you know, you could hear the audience just you know, that kind of thing, you know, despite the fact that the sound was, you know, blowing out your ventricles and your heart because it was, the bass is so loud, you know, you could still hear the audience gasp. It was incredible. Yeah.
Keep like sneezing blood by the end of the movie.
Am I supposed to be doing that?
Yeah. It was highly entertaining. I will give it that. Nailed that piece of it. So
for sure, and I think that also is part of the like, okay, you're playing it safe, but like, you know, there has to be a piece that like lets the audience in. I don't know. I mean, in terms of adaptation, I felt like it was successful in that way. I think you're right, especially bringing up the most exciting thing about the entire world and world building of Dune is, you know, that off-kilterness that really like, this doesn't seem like anything I've ever heard of or thought of before, you know?
Whoa, sandworms. You hate them, right?
Well, thanks for joining us yet again. This was another good episode. Thanks so much for talking Dune with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure to subscribe and follow us on all the podcasts and social platforms at the Grindhouse Institute. And if you really want to give us a boost, check us out on Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. It helps us to get noticed. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll be back next week.
Ciao.
I must admit, against all better judgment, I like this Duke.